I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Right now, we're deep in the heart of Texas in Sugar Land. And we're here with Donna Chang, who's the CEO of Hope Bioscience. Implicit in the name says a lot, doesn't it?
It does. It sure does.
Tell us about how you came up with Hope and your company that you operate here.
So welcome to Sugar Land, Tom. Yeah. It's really nice to have you. You know, we started this company 6 years ago with a mindset of making stem cell therapeutics a reality. The fact that we live with chronic degenerative diseases means that the only way to combat degeneration is by regeneration.
Uh-huh.
And so you need to find a solution for that. And we identified why these kinds of therapies are not available in the United States and what the limiting factors are.
What you're implying is that they might be available in Canada or in England?
Well, I'm sure by now your listeners are probably well aware that there are many stem cell options, not only from their local doctors, but there are, you know, people talking about going overseas for stem cells. So there's a lot of misunderstanding about what stem cells are, mm-hmm. how they work, what people are selling. Baby stem cells are better than adult stem cells. So much confusion and misconceptions out. And the reality is, in the United States at least, stem cells are regulated as drug products. In fact, anything that claims that it'll fix you is a drug. That means that there are bodies of people that regulate this and to make sure that what we're putting into our bodies are safe,
right,
and that when you spend the money for a treatment, that is in fact effective.
Okay, let's back up for just a moment. I want to get this out of the way.
Okay.
Kind of depoliticize the harvesting of stem cells.
Sure.
One, what is the controversy? What do people errantly think? And what's the reality?
Okay, so let's do a really quick science lesson here. Stem cells are cells that have no identity. They're basically cells that can become anything in the body, just like a seed can become any kind of plant, you know, without knowing what kind of seed it is. What you start off with when you first are conceived,
right,
we're all in our mother's wombs, we're initially conceived, we're essentially a big ball of stem cells. All the cells that are formed during that time will end up becoming heart tissue, skin tissue, brain tissue, all the tissues that make up our body came from a stem cell. So if you go back to the early days of stem cell research, embryos were readily used because embryos are essentially these cells, these magical cells that can become an entire human being.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine what it could do for disease. It could fix any disease. So the idea was great. It's just that, number one, you have an ethical dilemma with the usage of those kinds of products. And
because the right to life people think that you are killing a future life.
Right. So if you know, the use of an embryo itself. Now, aside from ethical issues, there are also safety issues. Over time, you know, these cells, again, they're wanting to become an entire human. So if you put it into an adult body, you run into these issues of creating little teratomas that are little masses of cells of all different kinds of cell types.
Mm-hmm.
So it's wonderful you fix a disease, but you can't leave little teratomas while fixing a disease. So the field started to move, especially when Bush defunded embryonic stem cell research. It really, I think, forced scientists into thinking of other ways of finding stem cells.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question became, okay, what happens after birth? Are there stem cells? Do we carry stem cells around with us?
That was my thought. Yeah. Why couldn't you not harvest stem cells from adults?
So let me give you a really easy example, mm-hmm. of and proof that you once had lots of stem cells. If you think back to when you're a kid, you get a cut, you bleed, you form a scab. All of that happens relatively fast. The older you get, you notice that takes a little longer. The healing process, scarring, it just takes forever. And our wrinkles don't go away, right? All of this is a factor of our regenerative process. So in all, we're losing cells constantly. And that example I gave you is a surface example. Internally, our organs are going through the same thing. Wear and tear, injury, this sort of thing. So your cells are constantly trying to repair, mitigate damage. But again, when we get older, It's not that disease is more prevalent as we age. It's that our defenses are much less as we age. So it appears like these things happen later in life. You know, these cells, stem cells, are obviously in an adult body. But if children have more, then the question becomes, okay, what kind of cells are these? Number one. Mm-hmm. And then number two is, then how many stem cells are we going to need to be able to fix a given problem? Because you got to think about it like a medication. Medication always has a dose. They don't just give you any medication without a dose. And then the third part, which is sort of the most missing part in the world of regenerative medicine, is this idea of repeatability. Going back to your question about source, where do you find stem cells? Imagine if we were able to find stem cells from adults, which we do. If we had to always go back into you to go get the source, particularly if it's an invasive process, then that's sort of not a very attractive way to go about this. After all, you wouldn't want to make a treatment from always having to go back into you. So we had to tackle those things. As far as we were concerned, there wasn't any point in looking at disease in a meaningful way until we were able to figure out these sort of massive hurdles. So the stem cells we focus on here are cells called mesenchymal stem cells. They're very particular stem cells that are readily found in adults, and they're in circulation, they're formed in the bone marrow, they're everywhere. You could take pretty much any tissue of your body and we would find mesenchymal stem cells in there. Our process here, we choose fat to take it out.
Oh, interesting.
This is a clinical trial site, so what you just saw was a clinical trial site of people actually receiving cells. But we require only a tablespoon of fat for this process, for us to be able to make cells from you.
And how do you physically extract that?
Any plastic surgeon can do it. Uh-huh. It's a very simple process. You basically numb the area.
Inject a needle.
It's an aspiration technique where you just take out some fat.
Yep. And then what's shelf life and viability of the extracted material?
So we have to process that pretty quickly. Fat is taken out all over the country, sent to us, and then we will then extract these MSCs that we're talking about. Now, when you hear about people talk about stem cells, they say, oh, fat stem cells, and put it into a category. That's not accurate. Fat is a source for stem cells. The stem cells in fat are unique in any way. Mm-hmm. I mean, they, from a cellular level, they may be all a little bit different, but I can tell you that fat is a great source for MSCs, and the reason why is because these cells, their sole existence is to keep your fat there. But now we're going to put them to work in a different way. So we're going to take them out of the fat, and we'll start with a very small amount. Now, this amount wouldn't do anything for anybody, but now the technique is making these into a lot, making these into therapeutic doses. So what is a therapeutic dose? For adults, what we have set with FDA is a 200 million cell dose. This is delivered intravenously, so we basically give the body back the cells sort of in the same way in which the body utilizes cells. We give them back in circulation, and then the cells find their way to where they need to go. That's the beauty of this. We don't need to direct them. Your body actually knows best. In a clinical trial, this makes it very frustrating, because if your goal is to fix brain injury, but there's some heart thing going on and cells decide to go there, we may never know. That's sort of a flaw to all of this, in a sense.
But maybe it's just fine-tuning the cells, those indicators, where someday they might know where to go.
And that is some, there are some people focused on some sophisticated engineering to get cells to navigate to particular areas and things. But what we produce here are essentially exactly the same stem cells that we pulled out from your body. So they will behave in that same way. We are not altering them really in any other way. So this army of cells that we create, to give you an idea of the magnitude, I mentioned the importance of being able to repeat this treatment.
Right.
So what happens is, after this tablespoon of fat comes in, we take about 2 months to create what's called a master cell bank for you. This master cell bank will follow you for the rest of your life. Anytime you need cells, we're going to pull from that master cell bank, and then we're going to grow new cells. And we can repeat this process over 1,000 times in your lifetime.
That's so.
So you'll have pretty much an unlimited supply of cells.
So to date, where are your best successes?
So we are just amazed at the speed in which we've been able to get into clinic with a lot of, in a lot of different indications. So far, these cells have been tested in 34 different protocols, FDA-authorized protocols, primarily neurological. We focus on neurological because neurological conditions need a lot of cells, and we make a lot of cells, so it's a good fit. We can tackle those kinds of things. You know, if you asked me 10 years ago, will someone with spinal cord injury walk again? The answer is it's never been done before. Today, it still hasn't quite been done before, but I can tell you that there is huge progress. We are seeing things happening, and these results are a testament to this repeatability concept. How many cells it's going to take. It really depends on how severe the injury is. How much do we have to repair? How long ago was the injury? All of these factors come into play. So 30, 50, maybe,
Would it be a situation, say, a traumatic car wreck, and the physician says, you know, we have some paralysis here. Would that be an optimal time to jump in?
Yeah, we've seen that the timing of things, first of all, we normally deal with chronic patients, chronically ill patients. That's what we do. But things like traumatic injuries, the sooner you treat things, the better chance you have.
Let's talk about degenerative diseases and how that works and the successes. You implied older people that are decomposing like me.
Well, let's take Alzheimer's dementia as an example. I know that that's an indication that is a very serious problem to our country, and we will see, we will start seeing some huge increases in this indication.
But this is more conceptual, theoretical at the moment?
No. We have trials. Specifically in Alzheimer's, we haven't started that trial. We will be shortly.
And that implies short-term memory issues too?
Yes. We are expanding it to any kind of cognitive decline due to Alzheimer's and dementia. We actually wrote a protocol, got it approved for like sort of mid-stage Alzheimer's. But what we are looking at is consistently, you know, you look at the disease spectrum. When do we treat disease here in America? You treat it once you get hurt, you start feeling pain or you're not feeling so good and you finally go to your doctor. That means that you're it's after you have symptoms. So these post-symptomatic stage that you're at may already be a very late stage in the whole disease spectrum. We think, oh, it's early, but in the whole disease spectrum, it's very late. So in cognitive decline, like Alzheimer's and dementia, these sorts of things can start 20 to 30 years before you even see your first symptom.
So let me interject for a moment. Does that imply that maybe a prophylactic application?
Well, we think it's prophylactic because we don't see a symptom.
Right.
But there are ways to find out whether people are prone to a disease. For example, genetic screening is a good way. You can find out whether someone is going to have Alzheimer's. You can do scans in the brain to see what the levels of proteins are, and you can see if someone's at risk. And if that's the case, then you know that this person is probably with almost to a degree of certainty that is going to develop a certain disease. So you want to tackle that at that stage.
Okay. Let's reset for a moment. Let's sit the girls here. Would you recommend they go for preventative screening? And if so, what and where and how?
Yeah. You know, it's funny when all of these genetic screening places came, and they have also some iPad questionnaires and apps and things that new sort of med tech technologies out there that you can accurately diagnose things beforehand. I used to think, who would want to know? If there's no way to fix this stuff, well, who the heck would want to know? So I thought, okay, their business plan is flawed until there's someone that has a solution that they can partner together and really sell the stuff. But yeah, we think in our mind that it's prevention, but the reality is that deterioration is happening. So it's
mitigation.
It is mitigation, and it's early mitigation, right? It's really early mitigation. And so that timeline of when we treat diseases, I hope we're going to see that come kind of, we're going to start taking that back, backwards in time, so that we tackle things really early. And I think in our, maybe we're too late in our generation, but our kids, definitely the way they treat disease will look very different from how we treat disease today.
It was a while ago, but I remember reading about kind of, like you implied, intelligent targeted T cells. That
right.
Talk to us about that for a moment.
I mean, that's it's a revolution, right, to be able to engineer cells in this way. I mean, what they've done in cancer is just amazing.
Give us your most, oh my gosh, example.
I mean, in the cancer world?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I had recently read the Times article about an 18-patient clinical trial they did for rectal cancer in which all 18 patients saw remission.
This is right now.
This is right. But this trial actually happened. The results of this was actually 2 years ago. These patients have been in remission for two full years mm-hmm. now. Not a trace of cancer.
The whole population of the trial.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in our world, they mm-hmm. say, well, if you don't have placebo, that doesn't. That's very compelling.
Well, data. Historically, that was a death sentence.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. Because you find out about those kinds of things so late. It's an exciting time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's exciting time. And shows the power of cells, biologics, we call these, right? They're living products. They're not chemicals in pill forms anymore. They don't carry the same kind of, like, in chemo. Now, you know, 20 years from now, they'll look back and say, wow, chemo was, that was barbaric. Mm-hmm. You know, you couldn't even touch the stuff without wearing gloves. You know, you can't, you're essentially killing the entire body to kill a cancer. But we're getting much more sophisticated. I think we've made great strides in cancer. I mean, it's just incredible.
So you're a pioneer on the frontier, excited about the future.
I am. I am very excited about the future, especially in the world of biologics. I think it's really an exciting time. I think in our country, it's funny, we do so much to protect the people, but sometimes our laws can't keep up with the advancement in technology. So as we advance in these ways, I hope that our legislators can work as quickly as they can to make sure that the laws can keep up with this change. Especially a definition of drugs. Again, we're not dealing with pills and, you know, single pathways of healing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're dealing with living products that can do 10 different things. So how are you going to regulate these things, right? And we've got to move quickly, though. To be the leader,
yep.
like we are, we mm-hmm. have to move quickly.
That's really cool. Before we go, let's back up. You grew up in Canada, outside of Toronto. How did you get from there to here?
To here.
Yeah.
It's been an amazing journey. Yeah, I grew up in Canada and then ended up in Bethesda, Maryland. Mm-hmm. My dad was transferred over there, so that was my first. I went to high school there and then went to college. Went back to Canada for college, actually, because it's really cheap. Cheap, inexpensive.
Yep. Did you go to McGill?
I went to University of Toronto.
Okay.
That's where I did my pre-med. I was a pre-med student. I discovered my fear of blood in my last year, a profound fear of blood,
wow.
Thus limiting my interest yeah. in going to medical school
yeah.
and took a year off and then came back to the United States. I went to Johns Hopkins for a new kind of biotechnology program. I've always been a technology buff. I just love new things. I love advancing in that way. And I felt like biotechnology would be cool just to learn the different things and things that you never learn in school, the latest innovations. So after getting a good exposure on different things, I was keenly interested in the area of regenerative medicine. I thought it was really interesting, but didn't see how it was actually going to translate into the real world. I ended up taking my first job as an economic development person.
Yay!
And I love the field of economic development because I just think it's just such an interesting area to be in because you're really trying to build an infrastructure in your city for growth. And my responsibility was to help build the life science community in Maryland. Of course, Maryland has a thriving biotechnology or bio landscape over there. And so I spent a couple years doing that and then came across a technology growing stem cells. I was fascinated by that.
So that was your kind of your game changer, your life changer.
That was my aha moment.
Yeah.
The day I saw cultured stem cells. So a small amount of cells becoming a really large amount of cells. That was it for me because it really answered this question of being able to make stem cells useful in the future, making doses that would work. Like, that was my aha moment.
Okay.
Yeah. And ever since then, I've just been completely engrossed in it.
But somehow you congealed everything and came up with a vision. Therein lies hope.
Well, it's interesting. If people were to ask me, 10 years ago, do you want to start a company? Heck no. Who would want that responsibility on their shoulders? Never had any interest in entrepreneurship or anything like that. It was really a solution to fix a problem. So if you want this technology to help a lot of people and make it available to everybody, that means it has to be affordable. Well, how are drugs affordable? Well, insurance pays for them. Okay, so how do we get insurance to pay for them? Well, you need this thing called FDA approval to get insurance to pay anything. And so then became the question, okay, well, how does one get FDA approval? I think you have to be pretty naive to start this. But
that helps.
So that was the mission. Okay, we're going to start and we're going to try go down this route so that ultimately we can try and reach this goal of making this available to everybody. And that's how Hope started. Our investor at the time had said, okay, you got to name the company to what you sell. Well, Stem Cells Inc. was taken. So we had to think of something else. And anyway, I thought Hope was exactly what we do.
That's so cool. Yeah. And how many employees do you have here?
So in 2020, we split. We created the Hope Biosciences Stem Cell Research Foundation because we started getting into human clinical research very early on in our existence. And we knew that clinical research is, first of all, very different from our expertise. We make cells really well. So we are a drug manufacturer, but clinical research is a totally different animal. So we needed to create a different entity. So that's why we founded the foundation. It's run by the Greater Houston Community Foundation here. It's a wonderful organization that is pioneering not only testing stem cells for all kinds of unmet needs, but they are really pioneering sort of the landscape of clinical research too. I didn't realize how antiquated clinical research is.
Wow.
We need a lot of savvy technology minds to come into the field of clinical research because there's a lot of things that just don't make sense. So we have to innovate in that area. So that's what the foundation does.
Okay, but you work in concert.
Yeah, and we hope that the foundation will grow to be able to service a lot of companies just like us, small companies that have great potential but don't know how to run a trial. This is where the foundation can step in.
Okay. To learn more about your world.
Yes, please visit our website. We have a great YouTube channel too. It's hope.bio. That's the website. No .com after that, just .bio. And our foundation is hopebio.org. And I just want to say, if you are out there and you'd love to donate to medical research and you feel like when you do, it's just going into this black hole, I can tell you here, it's different. Every dollar that's raised helps a patient, a real patient coming in here for a real need that no one can fix.
And they literally come in here.
They literally come through these doors. I think what makes this place so unique is that the drug is manufactured, tested, and given, walked downstairs, that's the delivery, to an infusion suite here. Of course, we have other sites as well that do research. We have a fairly large traumatic brain injury trial happening at the University of Texas. We run a lot of trials out of here now because now we have the ability to and the expertise to do it. But we have cells that go out all over the country in different protocols.
So it's CTE, right?
For
the brain.
Brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. We treat like full on traumatic brain injury. Yeah.
So there's a lot of hope there.
From what I've been hearing, yes. Yes.
Donna Chang, CEO, Hope Biosciences in Sugar Land, Texas. Thank you. What a wonderful morning.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, you've given me more hope. I'm Tom Wilmer. We'll see you down here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR stations.